Hey, it's Cole Swindell. After I give everything I've got to land a perfect vocal, I usually take five before jumping into the next track. And I've learned exactly how to recharge in that time. Some folks grab coffee. I hit a quick good luck spin. Next thing you know, the break is just as fun as laying down the track. A better break makes for a better take. Need a break? Let's chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNC supply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
In 2017, he was out on his mountain bike up on the north side of our county in a remote area, and he was shot and killed. I can't talk about everything the killer did at the scene. Thankfully, they did engage in several different actions that I think provide us clues. But it's like, here's this 60-year-old guy. He has no money. He is married, pretty newly married, but the marriage seemed okay. I think they did have some issues, but I couldn't find any kind of motive for his wife to be involved in this at all. It's on a random Thursday, the middle of the day, and he's out in the woods, and he gets shot and killed. It just seems so random, but there's attributes about the case that don't seem random.
I'm Steve Murphy, DEA Special Agent retired and now host of the Game of Crimes podcast. If you've seen the Netflix series Narcos, then you know my story. I now bring you stories of heroism and bravery from our law enforcement and military heroes, and occasionally from the criminals that they faced. Welcome to Game of Crimes. Hey, folks, welcome back to part two of this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. As always, thank you for coming back. We really got into it yesterday. I know it took us a little while to get to the cold case investigator part, but it's because our guest, Jen Buchholz, has such an interesting background. But if you go back and listen, if you haven't heard that, go back and listen to it, because it shows you how everything came together to lead her to where she is today. And that's a cold case file investigator. She told us yesterday about the case of Rebecca Gould. Still shocked by some of that, where she and another, he was a podcaster. Is that right, Rebecca? I'm sorry, Jen. I called you Rebecca. Sorry about that.
Yeah, investigative journalist, but he is a podcaster also now. Yeah, George.
Mm-hmm. And so these two pretty much solved the case. And when police went to talk to the guy, he confessed to it. But since then, he's confessed to five other murders, but nobody seems interested in that. So that was pretty shocking. So if there's any investigators from Arkansas, I hope this piques your interest and maybe reach out to Jen here and take a look at it.
Yeah, and they don't even know the whole story because, side note, I got this guy's laptop. So if they would like to know what's on it, I've tried to give it to them. But if they would like to know what's on it, please contact me.
Oh, wow. So I just go to the website to breakthecase.org. So it's Break the Case, B-R-E-A-K, thecase.org. And let's see. I see you got, you have a contact section on there. So
I do. Yeah, it's the easiest way to get a hold of me. Yep.
Excellent. Excellent. So now, and we want to talk about some of the cold cases that you've been involved with, but how did you get involved with the El Paso County, Colorado Sheriff's Office? Because I made that mistake yesterday thinking Texas.
That's okay. You're not the first. You won't be the last. Not a big deal. Well, we talked about how COVID hit in 2020. And so that State Department program I was working for got shut down. And so I was looking around for other opportunities. And it was actually my husband. He's like, hey, did you see the sheriff's office? They're hiring a civilian criminal investigator. I'm like, what's that? I didn't know that was a thing. Well, I looked at the job listing. I'm like, well, I meet all the requirements. I mean, why not? This sounds interesting. So went through a lengthy application and interview process with that, but ended up getting hired with my local sheriff's office. So there's actually four of us civilian criminal investigators. The other three, I'm the outlier. The other three are all retired law enforcement. I am not. But when I got hired with them a few years back, I started in financial crimes, which was interesting to a point. It can be mind numbing. Oh my gosh, so many numbers and spreadsheets. I learned a ton though. Like now I know how to use Microsoft Excel and, and you're still using your investigative skills. There's still a lot of interviewing, which I love and stuff like that. So, but, my predecessor retired the one who was working on cold cases before me. And so they offered me, they knew I wanted that position really bad. So they offered that to me when he retired. So I got to shift over. So I've been working on the cold cases for 2-3 years now, I guess. And I love it. Like, this is where I'm meant to be. This is my job. This is definitely what I love. And I have an amazing detective that I work side by side with. She's just as open-minded as me. And like, we joke about thinking outside the box that the box is in. So I think we're both pretty good at doing that and finding outside resources to help. And so, although she and I have not made any arrests yet together, we're getting there. I know we're getting there. But I can talk in general about some progress that we've made on some cases if you want to. But George and I are still working on other cases outside the sheriff's office on our own through our nonprofit. So can definitely talk about those.
Very cool. And that nonprofit is breakthecase.org, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, correct.
Go over and check it out, ladies and gentlemen, because I'm looking in here and it looks like there's 4 homicide cases and you've got a missing person case also.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So each, we really didn't want to start a nonprofit because I don't know anything about business or any, but we needed a website because we really wanted a place, a landing site for all the cases, all the victims. Wanted each victim to have their own page with all the content that's out there and make it easy for people to access. And then when we talk to victims' families or law enforcement agencies, it's just like so easy to tell them, just go to this website and you can see what we do. So that's how, but you know, we needed a name and all that. So that's how the nonprofit came to be. We didn't form it to solicit donations or anything like that. We do specialized donation options, I guess you could call it. Like right now, we have a reward fund going for one of our victims' cases. So people, they want to donate, they can donate directly to that reward fund if they want to help raise it. And then in the end, if the case gets resolved and we don't pay out the reward, we'll refund your money, or you can, you know, pay it forward to another victim's case that we're going to work on. So there's some donation options, but that's not why we formed it. So
how do you fund your investigations? You just pay out of pocket?
Yep. Self-funded. airline miles sometimes, hotel points, or just out of pocket. George and I, we take on a case, you know, we always travel to the location where the victim was killed before we ever go public that we're working on the case. We try to meet up with the family in person as well, but it depends where they're at. In our current case that we can talk about, the victim was killed in Washington, but none of our family lived there. So we have met up with the family in person, but we weren't able to do that before we took on the case. We were doing a lot of Zoom meetings. But George and I traveled up to Washington to get a lay of the land again, like see the crime scene, see the local area. If we have some suspects in mind in the early days and they're still in the area, we may do a little surveillance, a little door knocking before anybody knows who we are. And we have really great success in knocking on doors because I'm just a college professor and he's just one of my colleagues. And we're just kind of looking into this case and came across our desk and we were in the local area and couldn't find your phone number. So we just thought we'd stop by and it works every time. So I never introduce myself as actually being a cold case investigator or anything to do with law enforcement. And I'm not there in that capacity anyway, so there's no reason for me to, but yeah, wow. We work really well together. And obviously him as a journalist, he's used to interviewing people in a different way than I am, but it works really well together. And I think having a male-female team works really well too, because sometimes one person's more comfortable with one gender over the other and we can just kind of figure that out pretty quickly and play to it. So
before we get into that case, behind your head, I see an article on the wall that says Kennedy slain. Can you tell us about that?
So my mom was going through some of her stuff a few years back and she goes, I have all these old newspapers that I've saved. I don't know, maybe I should just, you know, give them away or throw them away. I'm like, no, don't. I mean, I love print journalism and I love writing. So anyways, I was like, would you be willing to mail them to me? She still lives in California. So she did. She mailed me this big box of these old newspapers. And I was going through. I'm like, God, these are so cool. These are just like a snapshot of history. So one year for my birthday, I don't really need anything anymore, but she's like, what do you want? I was like, you know what I really want? I want to get a couple of those newspapers framed, like really well, like professionally framed with the museum glass so that they're never going to get damaged. And so that's what she got me for my birthday that year. So I picked the Kennedy slain. I think it's just fascinating. It's also really good to frame, a nice one to frame because the headline's so big and it's easy to read. And I purposely asked them to keep the wrinkles in the newspaper. They're like, well, we could take the wrinkles out. No, no, no. I was like, it looks cool that way. You know, it is original. And then the one over here is a little harder to see, but it's from 9/11, where they were hoisting the flag up over the World Trade Center. And obviously 9/11 was like New York City, 9/11, all that's very close to my heart. I went to school in New York City. I was working in counterterrorism at the time 9/11 happened. So it, you know, hit me hard. And so I chose that one as the other. But I still have this whole, I got a better container, but to protect these newspapers. But I was like, eventually I have this dream of having them all framed like on a wall somewhere. So those two are the start.
That's very cool. And that's a great way to maintain history there. So that.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
The fact is they might be worth something, especially the one about Kennedy, because it is in such good condition, but that's not what it's all about.
No, no, it's about preserving them, you know, and I don't have kids, so I don't know who I'm going to pass them on to, but someday I'll meet somebody I hope that really loves them and I'll pass them on to them. So.
Very cool. Very cool. Okay. So, and I thought there was another question I wanted to ask you. We talked about now you guys have the podcast Break the Case, right?
We do.
Mm-hmm. And that's still active.
It's produced by the university I work at, which is awesome because they provide us a professional sound engineer, I think is his title. And he does a great job editing and doing the background music and all that stuff, making us sound way better than we normally would. But it's a serial type podcast. So each season is one case. And of course, growing pains as you learn how to make a podcast better. But the first season is on the Rebecca Gould case that we've talked about, the guys in prison, and he confessed to others. We had started that on a different platform with my editor at the university. So it's a little different format. And we transitioned it a couple years ago over to the Break the Case platform. So it's more discussion from me, George, and that editor about the case than it is going out and recording interviews. And then we kind of progressed as we got into season two and then season three. But two and three are more on the ground, more interactive for the listener. And you kind of just follow us through the investigation as we're conducting it. So season three is our current case of Linda Malcolm. I think there's 12 or 13 episodes. We haven't put out an episode in over a year on her case because we're not going to just put out content, and we don't make any money off doing it. It obviously takes a great amount of time to put these episodes together. So if we don't have something critical, I'm not going to just take up airwave space. But just know that we are still actively working on Linda's case and continuing to raise awareness for it. I have a spreadsheet of our interviews. I think we've done close to 100 interviews of different people. We tracked down people who were in the Netherlands. I tracked down somebody who was over in Portugal for that case. Like we didn't actually fly over there, but I was able to get them on the phone. Like there's just been a ton of work that's gone into her case. And now we're just kind of waiting on police to take those next steps, you know, to hopefully resolve it. So we try to give the listener. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Is that case in Colorado?
Nope. It's up in Port Orchard, Washington, which is such a beautiful area if you ever have the chance to go there. But Linda was a Navy veteran and she was stabbed to death inside her rental home in 2008. And then somebody set the house on fire and she was stabbed 24 times. There was definitely a dynamic fight that went on because she has many deep defensive wounds on her hands and arms. So she was, you know, not like someone just came in the middle of the night and stabbed her in the neck and that was it. She was upright and fighting her attacker. And we strongly, strongly believe that the killer was somebody pretty well known to her, that they'd been to her house before, that she knew the person. They knew her daily habits, knew that she'd be alone that night. I had this intimate knowledge about her life and her pattern of life, which immediately narrows down the pool suspects if you're pretty sure it's not a stranger homicide. So we strongly believe it's someone she knew.
How did you two become interested in that case and find out about it?
So a few years ago, through the university, George and I were ready to move on to a new case. So I put out a thing in our university newsletter that gets emailed out to all the students or whoever signs up or whatever. I knew it had a wide reach. And I put out a little article asking for case submissions. And we got about 75 or 80 cases submitted to us. And we went through the whole list. Yeah, and we have other people who help us with this too. It's not just me and George, but we have a small team of people to help us. And we went through the list, and some of them we could eliminate pretty quickly. Like, I hate this, but there was a guy walking along the highway in Texas and he got run over. I'm like, I can't do anything about, like, what am I going to do for that case? So there's some where we can kind of move down the list pretty quickly. So we ended up with maybe 10 good, like, okay, I think these ones are ones we might be able to make progress on. And so then we look for things like, how much media coverage has there been on the case? And does it appear police have done anything in recent years? And with Linda's, there was nothing. I mean, I hate the term cold case, honestly, because everyone thinks that means it's sitting on a shelf, not being worked, which isn't true. But in her case, I think that is what was going on. Like, there hadn't been a newspaper article in like 10 years or something. And if there's no newspaper article, then there's no, it was clear police weren't doing anything. Her family said they hadn't gotten an update in years. So we tend to like those smaller cases that are lesser known because we can start fresh. We're not trying to redo somebody else's work. We're not trying to compete for giving the case coverage. So hers kind of just fit all of the loose criteria we had. But the way it came to us is interesting. So a guy named Mike Booker is a student at the university, and he saw my call for case submissions. Well, Linda is his aunt. And so he submitted her case to us, and that's how we learned about it. And then when we got to know Mike and his family, he and I found out we only live about 20 minutes from each other. So he's practically down the road. Yeah, total coincidence. And he's also a military veteran, and he works in corrections here in Colorado. So we have a lot of things in common. So that was pretty neat to make that connection. But that's how it came to us. So we don't seek out cases. Like, we don't say, ooh, we want to work that one. Let's go contact the family. We take case submissions from, and we get submissions from, sometimes it's family, sometimes it's friends, sometimes the person submitting it didn't even know the victim. We've gotten some from law enforcement agencies too. So we get them from a variety of sources, but we're not going to, you know, go hound some victim's family to work on that case if they're not interested. So.
So in your capacity there with the El Paso County Sheriff's Office in Colorado, everybody, do you guys have cold case murder files there?
Many. Yes. Yes, we do. Unfortunately, like most agencies.
Yeah. What's the population of El Paso County?
I think we're at about 750,000 now. It's pretty big. And our cold case files, we're in the 30s. So a handful of those are missing persons. The majority are homicides. We do have a couple that are undetermined, but it's clear like somebody moved this body and disposed of it somewhere. So even though we can't determine the cause of death, there's still foul play going on. So we consider that one of them as well.
Right. So. And that's a part-time position for you. How many days do you work a week on that? Or a month?
I usually work 3 8-hour days. It just depends what's going on. It's super nice because my schedule's flexible. I mean, I usually just work Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday for 8 hours. But if I need to work on a Friday instead of a Tuesday, I can do that. If I need to go in on a weekend. And quite frankly, like if someone goes, oh, I'm only off work next Friday. Can we chat then? Yes, I'll just call you from home. I don't care. Something you learn from counterintelligence is don't ever pass up an opportunity to talk to somebody. It might be the only time that they feel comfortable talking to you. So if you got to take that call on a weekend, just do it. So that's the philosophy.
Yeah. And well, if they may be of the opinion that if you can't take a call from them when they're available, that you're just blowing them off.
Exactly that too, that you don't care.
And have you guys enjoyed any successes from that yet?
There was a case that was solved just before I moved over into this position. The victim's name was Karen Nichols. She went missing in 2012. And they had a very good idea of the top suspect pretty soon after she went missing. They had linked her to a guy that she met on an app called Backdoor, something like that. It's my apologies, I can't remember. And, you know, it's kind of like a hookup. It was a hookup site. I don't think it's in existence anymore. And her phone pinged kind of going in the direction of his house, and then she vanishes. And so he's brought in for an interview, of course, denies everything, says, no, I left her to, I think he said, left her at a gas station. She was fine. She was alive, whatever. They want to search his property. They did go out there. I think they had a search warrant back in the day, but it's a massive property, and his parents owned livestock. And when like a horse would die, they'd bury it on the property. So they decided not to use ground penetrating radar because they're like, yeah, we're going to find anomalies, but it's probably a horse. And then it just kind of, it went cold, I guess you could say. And then my predecessor came in and he started reviewing the case and he goes, hey, the suspect has an ex-wife now. I love ex-wives. Oh my gosh. He goes, oh, I see he's divorced. Maybe we should go talk to his ex-wife. Lo and behold, she gives up the goods and tells the whole story. She wasn't involved, but he confessed to her. But no one ever went and knocked on her door. That's the other thing. Like, a lot of people will not just call law enforcement and report this kind of stuff. You got to go seek it out. So they flew out to the East Coast and interviewed her, and she basically told the whole story of what he had told her. So they went back to the property with another search warrant, and they found Kara Nichols buried on top of a horse. So he had obviously done that on purpose in case ground penetrating radar was used. But thankfully, she was found. So that was in 2021, I think, and then he was arrested. And I got to see him sentenced a couple years ago in court. So that was pretty satisfying. Sucks that it took a decade, but at least he's where he needs to be. He's obviously a dangerous guy, and he'll be in prison for quite a few years.
When you're investigating a cold case file, I mean, you have all the investigative techniques available to you. Are there some that are more beneficial and fruitful than others? I mean, what is it that you rely on? You just said that you love an ex-wife.
Yes. It's obviously case dependent what techniques are going to be best. I mean, something I love about working cold cases is, first of all, it's not dictated to me. They're like, basically do what you see fit. So I sit down with a case for weeks and study it. And you have to become the subject matter expert on it. It can't be something you just work on a couple hours a month. You're not going to get it. You got to grasp every little detail of what's been done, who has said what, and all the connections. And I often make charts or family trees of all those connections and evaluate the evidence. Like, is there evidence that could be tested now with new technology? So we are doing that in a 1988 homicide case. When I came on, I started studying this case. The victim's name is Tawana Lewis. I actually put out a press release about the case a few months back, hoping maybe somebody would call in with a tip, but also just to let our community know, like, we care about her. And I know nothing was done for a long time, but I definitely care. And we definitely want to get progress on this case. So Tawana was found floating in a farmer's irrigation ditch back in 1988. She'd been strangled. There was no ligature around her neck, but her wrists had been bound, and the bindings were still on her wrists. And so I went back and I looked, and nothing had ever been done with the bindings. So I went over to evidence, and it was kind of surreal opening this envelope that's marked 1988 that's never been opened. But there's the bindings, and they're like in perfect condition, and there's three knots in them. And so I'm like, it's really hard to tie knots with gloves on. And back then, I don't think the killer was worried about, you know, DNA wasn't a thing. So he wasn't worried about it. So there's a good chance his skin cells are on these bindings. And I actually talked to Paul Holes, if you know who he is, Cut the Golden State Killer. he lives here locally now, and he said he has had success with getting touch DNA off evidence that's been in water. So he's like, give it a shot. So we sent in the bindings to be swabbed, and they didn't get anything. I'm like, okay. So I'm like, okay, what else can we do? So I start researching MVAC, which is a forensic vacuum. And George actually knows the CEO, Jerry Bradley, who invented MVAC. And so I call him and I'm like, what do you think? And he goes, I think you got a good chance. We've used it on rope before with success. And he goes, and so he gives me a contact at a police department up by Denver who has an MVAC because we don't have one at our lab and they're not going to buy us one. So then I call that detective. Like, this is how it works, right? All these connections. I call that detective. I explain our case. He goes, bring up the bindings. I'll MVAC for it. MVAC them for you. It won't take long. I'm like, okay, amazing. So we take him up there and he does an MVAC on him and gives us this MVAC filter and I go put it in evidence. And then the next challenge is who's going to analyze this filter because our Metro Crime Lab doesn't do it and the state level bureau doesn't like dealing with MVAC stuff. And I was like, well, I don't want to send it to a place that already doesn't like working on it. So it took a few months, but we finally got a grant through a nonprofit called Season of Justice to send the filter to a private lab out in California that specializes in this type of evidence. And so literally that MVAC filter just got FedExed out today to them. So now it's another waiting game. We got to wait 30 or 60 days to see how their analysis goes. And then it's complicated, right? Because you also need the victim's DNA profile to compare so you can eliminate her out of whatever they may get. So we got another lab working on that. But I'm hopeful, like, maybe they will get those skin cells of the person that killed her. So, and give us a lead.
Did you call that NVAC?
M, like Mike. VAC, yep. So it is a forensic vacuum. It's actually a super simple system. And it's best with porous surfaces, like fabric, rope is fine. And it shoots out a sterile solution and then it sucks back it sucks up all of that solution and anything in the solution, which you're going to get lint and dirt and fibers, but you're going to get all the human skin cells too, if they're there and they get caught up in this filter. And then the lab that specializes in analyzing that filter can find the skin cells in there, essentially, and then hopefully develop a DNA profile out of them.
Wow. I never heard of that.
Yeah. It's cool stuff.
That's what I say, the technology, the forensic technology, I guess, is that's never been anything I've investigated, but wow.
Definitely advancing. I mean, it's not applicable in every case. In some cases, it just don't have that evidence to test, you know. Okay, so it's like, what else can we do? Or if you don't have a body, like we're working on a no body homicide right now, I don't even have the person's body, so you know, so evidence testing doesn't really come into play. So each case is different what you got to use, but I said to my partner when I first came on, I was like, she goes, well, we don't have a forensic testing budget. I'm like, I'm not letting money stop us from solving cases, we'll find the money. And so we've done pretty good. We can talk about Ramapo College if you want, but they've got an amazing program that has helped us tremendously. So we have a 1986 case of a homicide victim that was found in a field. He was skeletonized, no ID, shot in the head. And since 1986, we haven't known who he is. He's been a John Doe. They've done the composite sketches and the clay molding, and we've put those photos out. No luck. And it's like, how do you investigate a homicide if I don't know who the victim is? Yeah. So last year, on my social media, I was looking for funding to do genealogy to try to figure out who this guy is. And because you need a different type of DNA profile than you do for the CODIS database that the FBI runs. Well, to get that specialized, that other type of DNA profile is thousands of dollars at a private lab. And unfortunately, like, this is very common, but our law enforcement chain of command didn't really understand what, just send it over to the Metro Crime Lab. I'm like, they don't do this type of analysis. So somebody recommended, they're like, hey, there's a program at Ramapo College, which I'd never heard of. So I looked it up. They're in New Jersey. So they have a genetic genealogy training certificate program for students. And they help law enforcement agencies utilizing their students that they're training to identify unknown human remains. And they pay for all of it. And I'm like, huh. So I submitted our case. And we had a meeting with them like early last year. And they said, yeah, they offered up their cert. They're like, we'll take on your case. We will pay to have the DNA profile developed. And our program will do the family tree building and the genetic genealogy to try to identify your person. So they, I mean, that's like an $8,000 to $12,000 savings right there. And the money we never would have had anyways. And so I got the DNA profile from this guy's teeth. I don't know if you know anything about genetic genealogy. I don't need to go on a rant about it, but like basically it's using open source family tree building type stuff and open source historical records to build this unknown person's family tree and find relatives to narrow down who your person likely is. And that's what they train their students to do in this program. And so on Thursday last week, they're like, hey, we have an update for you.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
So we get on Zoom with them and they have a PowerPoint ready for us. And like, this is your guy. And they gave us a name. We're like, oh my God. I mean, me and Jen cried. Like, After 40 years, we probably know who this man is now. And we never would have figured it out any other way because he was never reported as missing. None of his family members were felons, so they weren't in CODIS. That's why there was never a DNA match. Like, we never, ever would have been able to figure it out except through genealogy. And so we still have to do a final DNA confirmation. Thankfully, he has a brother and a son who are alive. So we contacted both of them and they both agreed to give us their DNA. And so then the lab can do a direct comparison, a one-to-one comparison to confirm that we have the right identification. But so far, everything's falling in place for it to be him. So it's like, what a feeling to be able to give a victim back their name, first of all. And then we'll be able to give his remains to his family for a proper burial. And then we can start a homicide investigation and hopefully find his killer.
I know the viewers can't see me when you're talking, but my chin's sitting on my desk. It's amazing what you're doing with that one case. When you talk to the brother and the son, what did they think happened to the victim?
Well, the son was an infant when his dad went missing or was killed. And we're still trying to narrow down when he was killed. We know when he was found. But we know he'd been there several months because he was skeletonized. So we're working on the time of death. But the son was an infant. So he was born the year that the skeleton was found. So he never knew his dad or anything about him. He did say somehow, he heard through the grapevine, his dad was in the witness protection program. And that's why he'd never met him. We're like, I don't think so. But so the son didn't really have any insight. But the brother, he said he was in and out. My brother was in and out of jail and the Molsa family was living in Texas. He left. We just figured he was back in and out of jail or just doing whatever. And so I will say, if you're a family member in this position where you have a family member that has gone off the radar and you haven't heard from in years, please, please, please go make a missing persons report and give law enforcement your cheek swab. Because your missing person may be in the database, but unidentified, and your cheek swab can help us identify that person and locate them. So just a kind of public service announcement there. But the brother just didn't really know. I guess his brother was a little bit transient and would wander around the country, and so they just lost track of him.
What's the name of that college in Jersey you mentioned?
Ramapo College. I cannot say enough good things about their program. They communicate so well. They kept us updated through the whole process. Even when they first got some DNA information. They're like, it looks like his ancestry, they sent us an email. It looks like Western European mostly, but a little Croatian. I'm like, oh my God. I mean, they didn't have to tell us all that. And I've studied the genealogy stuff. Like, I've gotten trained in it. So it's very interesting to me because I have a good understanding of how it works. But they've been just so good at communicating. So if there's any agencies out there that have unknown human remains, I would definitely reach out. They do tend to lean towards wanting to identify homicide victims over other remains where the cause of death is undetermined, which I understand. Like, we probably should give the homicide victims some priority, but I do have another John Doe case where we don't have a cause of death, and I've been struggling to find funding to identify him. But fingers crossed, I think NamUs might come through for us and help us establish funding for that one. But one way or another, I'm going to find it.
Yeah, yeah. A dogged investigator. That's a good thing. What was that? You mentioned NamUs?
So yeah, NamUs is the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System. Let me look.
And while you're looking for that, I looked up Ramapo, R-A-M-A-P-O, for those that are interested.
Yes. Yeah. National Missing and Unidentified Persons System. So that is a nonprofit but government website where if you have a missing person from your jurisdiction or an unidentified remains, you can put them in there. And the goal is, like, we'll search through there periodically on our John Doe to see if there's any new missing persons reports that might match when he went missing and the circumstances and stuff like that. But they do apparently go look for funding from different areas to help agencies with these issues of identifying unknown people. So very, very good resource.
What about the military has a unit that searches for bodies of missing servicemen? I guess you'd have to determine that your victim was in the service to start with, or does that only apply to wartime situations?
That's a good question, because I haven't dealt with them, so I'm not positive, actually. I have dealt with, so Army CID now does have a cold case unit. It's very new, but I'm not sure how to answer. I don't have the answer to your question. I just don't know. I would have to do some research to find.
There's a good friend of mine who helped me create this podcast, Morgan Wright. He was my co-host up until about a year and a half ago, and his real job got more demanding of his time. But he loves this kind of stuff. I'm going to have to make sure he listens to this episode, but also I'll call him and talk to him about you, because he's always involved. He's created. Yeah, and he's created an app that they're testing in the state of Virginia now on solving crimes. And for me to try to even explain it to you, all I would do is confuse you, because I'm confused about it too. He's a lot smarter than I am. But there's not to get away from your story, but on another case, my old DEA partner, Javier Pena, and I are involved with a group called the Lost Clipper, which you can look at thelostclipper.com. And it involves the disappearance of 15 Americans in 1938 over in Micronesia in the South Pacific. Yeah, we've been over there a few times. I've been over twice. I think the team has been over there five times. And our last trip, which was April of 24, I believe, we took cadaver dogs with us. And we had brought a scientist on to our team, our investigative team, and he pulled NOAA maps and weather reports from since 1938. And through, I mean, just you talk about a dogged investigator. He said, I think I'm within 50 meters of where the bodies may have shifted to since 1938 because of storms and so forth. And so we took the cadaver dogs out one at a time. And the first one went over, and our guy, his name's Jim, pointed out where he thought they would be. And the dogs alerted immediately. The first dog did. So you flag where everywhere the dog alerts. Pull the first dog out, second dog goes in, and he does alerts on the exact same places. So we brought back some large slabs of concrete that we believe contain DNA. And the trouble now is finding somebody that can fund it, because we've been funding this ourselves for years and years. And it's getting really expensive.
Yeah, it's getting very expensive. Yeah, especially when you're talking about lab work now. I know. That's incredible, though. I mean, what an effort you guys have gone to. I commend you. Thank you.
We're people that came on. Javier and I came on later in the investigation, but the guys that created this guy, Knopf Singer, was a military intelligence officer, and this was his thesis when he went through Staff and Command College. So he's been investigating it that long. It's been over 20 years for him. But so back to the sheriff's office. I just looked up. So you're there in is it Carson City? Is where you are?
Colorado Springs.
I'm sorry. Actually, that's a very nice place. I've gotten to visit there once. The sheriff's office, I don't know how you put a limit. I know you have a limited budget, but I don't understand how they can't come up with funding when you're trying to solve a murder, because there's no more serious crime than a murder. And I'm not criticizing the SO out there. So if you're listening there, sheriff and deputies, that's not what this is about.
No, not at all. And this is a common problem across agencies throughout our nation. So it's not just mine. I think it's because, and I'm hoping one of these days soon, I could just sit down with the sheriff and give a presentation on why we do need a dedicated forensic testing budget. And I don't need a ton of money, like $20,000 a year would probably be sufficient, which isn't a lot in the whole scheme of things. It's just never been done before. And I don't think the chain of command really understands the need, or like there's only certain capabilities a publicly funded lab has. And that's across the nation also. These publicly funded labs, they don't do genetic genealogy. They don't do that type of DNA extraction and development. It's just, it's too expensive. They would need all new equipment and training. I mean, it would be probably hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we definitely don't have that. But just to have a forensic testing budget, so like when I do need to use a private lab for $8,000, you know, there's something there to help. But as you've learned, I'm going to go find the money somehow anyways. But yeah, that's something I hope I can affect some change in the future, is getting them to dedicate a little bit of money each year to help us out on that stuff.
That's what makes a good investigator, is you don't give up.
No, I won't.
Whether it's lack of evidence or lack of funding or the challenges of interviewing people.
There's always something to do. I hate when I hear, oh, we've exhausted all leads. There's always something more you can go do on every case. There's always. So I don't live by that philosophy at all. If I hit a dead end, I'm like, okay, next, you know, and I don't know. And again, I think that's kind of comes back from my military training too, and just the patience you have to exhibit and the creative thinking sometimes. And so it comes into play.
Do you think that part of the challenge associated with that is just the overwhelming amount of cases that are coming in and just lack of manpower?
Yeah, I think, yeah, resources and manpower, because of course, the new cases take priority, right? And so that's what the detectives get assigned to work on. And these older, unresolved ones, unfortunately, get pushed aside in agencies where they don't have a cold case investigator or a unit. I heard back many years ago, they were trying something where they'd assign each detective a cold case to work on in their free time. And it never happened because they just didn't have the free time. So, and it's a challenge my partner runs into, because she still does work active cases, but they're really trying hard to just let her and I do our thing with the cold cases and do their best to not assign her a new one. Like, she still has to go out on call every third or fourth week or whatever, but they're trying hard to get other detectives to take those cases. So I'm like, hopeful.
We had a former guest on here, and he's going to kill me, because I can't think of his name right now. And I'm looking on the Ramesh Nyberg, who was a detective with Miami-Dade Police Department for a number of years and spent, gosh, if I remember, he was 14 years on their cold case squad, and just some amazing stories. But he's retired now. He teaches school, but just a super guy. It's but that's an agency that's large enough that they can afford to assign a few detectives to work cold cases.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he'd be an interesting one to talk to for sure.
If you're ever interested, I'll make the introduction. I don't mind at all. He wrote a book. It's a really good book. I want to ask you about one more case that you could tell us about, but I'm just curious. Have you ever taken a look at the JonBenet Ramsey case?
Not in any official capacity. We've had many emails, George and I have, about like, you guys need to take on her case. I'm like, I'm not touching, no, a 10-foot pole. But yeah, I mean, I've done some reading on it because I never like to call a case fascinating. That's not really fair to the victim, but it is a strange case. There's good arguments for both sides of the coin of whether it was an outside intruder or somebody in the family. And I go back and forth myself, but one interesting connection, I guess you could say, is I was going through one of our cold case files on a case several months back, and I found a handwritten note from Lou Schmidt. I don't know if you're familiar with his name, but he was a detective at our agency many, many years ago, but he worked the JonBenet case till he died, literally, and did some amazing work on it. So it was kind of cool to like see this handwritten note with his signature, you know, like, oh my gosh, that's right. You know, but I'll keep my opinion about the case to myself, but what I will say is everyone's like, oh, DNA in her underwear or whatever it is. My understanding is, and we're in the same position in some of our cases with this, it's a partial profile. So you cannot do genetic genealogy unless you have a full DNA profile. A partial, the only thing it possibly can be good for is, I won't even say elimination purposes, but if you have a suspect DNA and you can do a one-to-one comparison, you can say either the suspect DNA is consistent with that partial profile or it's not. But I've seen a lot of ranting online about, I don't know why they're not doing genetic genealogy. Well, it's because they don't have full profile to work with, so they can't. The technology's not there yet.
Yeah. All right. And we still got a little bit of time here, if you don't mind. You don't, in your side business with Break the Case, that doesn't have to be high-profile people that have been killed. That you guys just, whatever case comes along, right?
Yeah, we won't do high-profile cases anyways. They've been worked on so much. There's already been so much media attention. And there's a lot of controversy and arguing that comes along with those high-profile cases. And it's way less likely law enforcement's going to work with us on a case like that. So if it's an unknown case with a small agency, there's a much higher chance that they're going to be willing to do some collaboration with us. But you'd be surprised, even though I'm in law enforcement and I do this for a living, how many agencies do not want to work with me and George. So it's
really
something else I'd love to affect change on throughout the country is like collaboration. But there's a big ego problem and we don't want some outsiders coming in and solving our case that we couldn't solve. And it's not a matter of them not being capable of solving it. It's just sometimes you just need outside eyes. So, or a different way of thinking about it. Yeah.
And unfortunately, it's DEA. It doesn't matter where you go. There's that competitive spirit. People call it type A personalities, but you're right. It's egos.
Yeah. I would love someday, I don't know if this will ever happen, but I'd love to have multiple teams around the country and each team just working on one case and in collaboration with the investigating authority. And that doesn't mean agency has to like give us the whole case file, which we have had happen, but at least collaborate with the team and brainstorm, you know, on things they can share. And our team has an advantage where we have the time to go seek people out and interview them. And I don't have to Mirandize anybody. Like, I don't have a badge or a gun. Like, me and George are much less assuming and like lower profile and less alarming, I think, to people. And so why not use that to your advantage? Like, I've said at work, I'm like, man, I wish some podcasters would go take a look at some of these cases we got and see what they can dig up or who will talk to them. I would love that, but I can't direct somebody to do that. But I would love that kind of information.
It just, to me, it sounds like another tool in an investigator's toolbox.
It is. if someone like me and George showed up at my work, I'd be like, let's go. They probably won't let me share the whole case file with you. That's fine. We can still work together and come up with some ideas. So,
yeah. How about one more case that that would be really interesting, at least interesting to you, that we'd like to hear about?
There's one more. Obviously, I can only talk about the publicly information that's already been publicly disclosed and not some of the holdback information. But one of the cases at work that really bugs me is the case of Tim Watkins. And in 2017, he was out on his mountain bike up on the north side of our county in a remote area, and he was shot and killed. And I can't talk about everything the killer did at the scene. Thankfully, they did engage in several different actions that I think provide us clues. But it's like, here's this 60-year-old guy. He has no money. He is married, pretty newly married. But the marriage seemed okay. I think they did have some issues, but I couldn't find any kind of motive for his wife to be involved in this at all. It's on a random Thursday, the middle of the day, and he's out in the woods, and he gets shot and killed. And it's like, what in the world? It just seems so random. But there's attributes about the case that don't seem random. And I actually got permission to bring in an outside expert. I'm not going to name who it is right now. But to bring in an outside expert on this case to consult with us and try to give us more ideas. So it's a struggle because we have no digital evidence. So there was no cell phone signal where he was, and up on a bike trail, there's no video or anything like that. There is a dirt road that's drivable by car within a couple miles, but traffic on this road is rare. So no witnesses. But something I did, so when I went back and started working on this case, I learned that there's an app called Strava that a lot of mountain bikers use to track their rides. And so I was actually able to track down probably at least a dozen people who had ridden in the area that day. A couple of them were able to look back in the app and see where they went, other riders that were in the area. Like that was super helpful. It didn't give me the magic piece of information, but at the same time, it's helping me with a timeline of, okay, you rode the trail at this time and didn't see anything and stuff like that. And it's tedious, but I think it gave me some good info. But yeah, this case is a struggle because there's just no digital evidence. I mean, we know his last phone call and where his phone last pinged, but it's miles from where he was found. So it doesn't really help me much other than narrowing in a time of death, like, oh, okay, I know he was alive at 11:09 because he spoke to his friend. And so there is some media coverage out there on this case. If people want to read up on it, and please, seriously, if you have ideas, like, send me an email. I'm always open to listening to people's investigative ideas because I can't think of everything. But that one really bugs me. I really dug into his victimology hard. I mean, I interviewed probably 40 or 50 people who knew him who hadn't been interviewed before. And it's like, the guy is squeaky clean. He has no red flags. Like, usually you dig up some kind of dirt, can't find anything on him. I'm like, what would motivate somebody to take out this guy? So
how did you find that website about people going off, where they're biking at?
So I talked to one of his friends and he goes, have you ever used the Strava app? And I said, no. And he goes, yeah, it's for tracking your ride, or you can use it for hiking too, but you track your rides. But he's like, you can also see on the map and the data if there were other riders who were in the area that day that you were. I'm like, oh, so what do you see? And so I called a couple of people and they were able to go back to 2017. Oh yeah, I rode this trail at 1:30 in the afternoon and it took me this long and stuff like that. And oh yeah, and I see that this person was also out that day. And thankfully, nobody seemed to mind that I got their name that way, but everyone I called was very helpful. But it's just one of those things like I didn't know about and someone introduced me to. And so I used it to my advantage in the investigation. And maybe someday it'll reveal something or fall in line with something new. But unfortunately, our victim was not using the app. I wish. But I couldn't track him.
When was that murder committed?
2017. And his name is Tim Watkins. Yeah. Yep. And he was very well known in the mountain biking community. He had actually built the trail that he was shot on. It's ironic. He did a lot of trail maintenance in the area. He had developed a lot of the mountain biking trails in that area where he would ride all the time. So I go back and forth whether in my mind, like, could he have been targeted? And then who would, you know, if he was, I mean, there's got to be somebody who knew his work schedule, knew he's off work on Thursday, knew where he'd be riding. Like, that's a lot of intimate information to know. There can't be that many people who would know all that. But then maybe he wasn't targeted. You know, maybe this was just an altercation and and something went awry. But I'm hopeful. We have sent in some evidence. I'm not going to say what it is, but some pieces of evidence for retesting with new technology at a private lab. So I'm like, okay, fingers crossed, please, that gives us a lead. So we'll see. Yeah.
I've got one of my best friends from high school lives in Chattanooga, Tennessee, or near Chattanooga. And man, he is Mr. Outdoors. He was in high school and he's retired now. But he spends a lot of time on those trails in the Smoky Mountains. And he's real big on making sure the trail's in tip top shape. And I can see where they have a vested interest in that. Maybe this is Murph's pontification here, but you know, it makes you wonder if somebody did something, left some trash on the trail and he challenged them and that's all it took to set somebody off. There's Murph's 5-second analysis of the case.
No, it's it's fair. Or did he come across the person shooting? Because this is an area where you're not supposed to shoot. Did he come across them and they were shooting illegally and he got mad and then it escalated? I have a list of different scenarios, you know, as I think of them. Of the motive and what kind of led to this. Because if I can figure out the motive, I can probably figure out the killer.
There you go. And so all you super sleuths out there, you're always looking for something to investigate. There you go. She has offered for you to contact her if you have thoughts on this.
Yes.
So go to breakthecase.org, go to the contact section and put in your thoughts.
Please. And if you're interested in helping our team with projects, like, I was looking for volunteers. Some of the stuff is tedious, but some of the things we need help with are just, you don't need any special skill set, just a phone or computer where you can do some online research. I'm referring mainly right now to that project about William Miller and his other 5 victims and whether they exist. So if you're interested in helping us with that, please shoot me an email and I'll get you access to the information and spreadsheets that we have going on that.
There you go. I mean, if you're interested in this at all, you're not going to make any money off of it, but.
No, I can't pay you. I can't pay you, but you might get some amazing experience.
There you go. And some self-satisfaction in life that you've helped somebody else or helped their family out. I'm shocked about the volunteer part because just recently in interviewing, January was Human Trafficking Awareness Month and brought in Tyler Schwab from Libertas and brought in Chad Melly from protectall.org, and they have volunteer positions. And I'm thinking, how in the world would you be a volunteer on that unless they want you to pretend to be a pervert or something like that? But they have a variety of things just like you talked about. That's outstanding. Outstanding.
Yeah. It's interesting because we get a lot of emails like, I want to, and everybody listen to podcasts, I want to solve a cold case. And it takes a lot of patience. A lot of people give up. And we know that it's okay. Like it's, even if you help us for a little bit and you get sick of it, that's fine. But if you do feel like you have good research skills and have some patience, like we'd be glad to have you help us along the way. And I do think we're probably going to try to start a new case this year. We've been working on Linda's for 3 years. We kind of feel like we've exhausted our resources on that. And are waiting on police to do some things on their end. But, always looking for people that want to help.
There you go. So before I let you go, Jen, do you have any words of advice or wisdom for people about, based on all your experiences, especially in cold case and missing persons investigations, that you'd like to leave everybody with?
Oh, my gosh. That's a big question.
It is.
Never give up. And just remember who you're working for, right? If it was your family member or loved one that was killed or went missing, you know, you would want the investigator to do everything possible. And I truly believe there's never an end to that road, especially when you're in law enforcement. There's always something else you can find that will develop a lead or a direction to go. And even if it ends up being the wrong direction, well, at least you answered a question. So just never give up. And don't be averse to bringing in outside experts or looking for outside experts. You know, like, we do have missing persons cases, and that's not my background, but I have sought out training in it. And then I've sought out assistance from a couple other agencies and persons that do specialize in missing persons to help me. Like, I can't do an investigation by myself. Nobody can. So just because someone might not be have a badge and a gun and be in your agency doesn't mean you can't utilize them. So there's so many resources out there. So don't let that stop progress in a case, please.
Yeah, it's hard to check our egos sometimes, but that's what's mm-hmm. required.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, listen, if everybody you want to find out more information here, Jen's website is breakthecase.org, O-R-G. Her podcast is Break the Case as well. On YouTube, you can find her at Jen Buchholz, B-U-C-H-O-L-T-Z, P-I, like private investigator, and also at Break the Case. On Instagram, Jen Buchholz, C-C-I, and as well as Break the Case, N-P, for nonprofit. On Facebook, Jennifer Buchholz and Break the Case. And on X, Break the Case Nonprofit. And I even found Jen on LinkedIn, that Jen Buchholz. You mentioned your book, There is No GOAT, that came out in 2024, but you had another book, didn't you?
Yeah. George and I co-wrote a book on a case we worked on in Lubbock, Texas. It is, spoiler alert, still unsolved. But I think if you read the book, you will be able to draw your own conclusions on what happened to this girl. But yeah, so we co-authored that book. Yep. And there is a chapter in there about the Rebecca Gould case too.
And I was joking around while we were not recording about who killed Debbie Sue, like the song, but and you can find both those books on Amazon. So check this stuff out. The reason I read off all the sites is a lot of people listen to the show on audio and not video. On video, there's this, you saw a placard come up on the screen there with all the contact sites to go. But Jen, thank you so much for your time. And I mean, what an eye-opening discussion. I think everybody is probably interested in cold cases and especially how those get solved. And it sounds like the biggest thing is taking those blinders off, thinking outside the box. Don't think that one individual has all the answers, willing to open up to other information and other sources. So it's been an honor to have you on here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure, and I really enjoyed this conversation. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So everybody, listen, thank you guys again for coming to every week to listen to the Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Next week, we'll have another great guest. And two episodes from now, we'll have Barbara Butcher on here as a guest, who Jen got to work with in the New York City Medical Examiner's Office. I just finished reading her book, and wow. I mean, you got to come and listen to that. I don't know how you did it, Jen, and I don't know how Barbara did it for so many years. But stuff you don't want to miss here on Game of Crime. So I say it every week. Don't understand why you keep coming back, but I know why you do. And the same reason I do is because we enjoy playing the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all. And that's our Game of Crimes. God bless you all. Stay safe out there. See you next week.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.